It's the last doctor's exam that you're ever gonna get, the autopsy. When a person dies unexpectedly, it's up to the medical examiner to figure out just what happened. Was it a homicide, a malpractice, a natural death? It takes a lot of training and some gruesome cases to teach a forensic pathologist to unravel these everyday medical mysteries. In her new book, Working Stiff, Dr. Judy Melinak dissects the process of becoming a death investigator. The book tells the story of her rookie season in the New York City morgue, a city where she says there are a lot of interesting ways to die, like boiling to death in a steam tunnel as others watched helplessly being cooked just like a lobster. Judy Melinak is a forensic pathology and assistant clinical professor of pathology at UC San Francisco Medical Center. Welcome, Judy.
Thank you for inviting me.
Before we get going, I want to share with our listeners a case. A few days ago, you shared one of the cases with us. It's a medical mystery you call the Pink Eye of Death. And you asked Sci-Fi listeners to see if they could figure out what happened. Could you briefly lay out that case for us?
Sure. A 30-year-old man goes into an emergency room and complains of a headache and neck pain. He's sent home with ibuprofen and told it's a tension headache. Then he returns a week later, but now he's got red eyes, a headache, neck pain, and nausea, and the headache's worse. He dies in the hospital shortly after admission, and so the case was referred to the medical examiner. And the death was referred because it's sudden and unexpected. The only significant medical history is that he had been shot in the face as a teenager and was blind in the right eye. So when I did the autopsy, I found that he had meningitis, which is a pus infection of the brain. And the infection grew out an organism called Staphylococcus aureus, which is a bacteria that usually infects wounds, not brains. The pus extend all the way to the gunshot wound track around the eyes, and that's where he had the pink eye. Mm-hmm. So the question I asked was, is this a homicide or a natural death? What do you think happened?
Mm-hmm. And if you think you know what happened, if we'd like to hear Dr. Melinak talk about it again, it's on our website at sciencefriday.com. We have that description of the case. And we have some really interesting answers and guesses about that case up there already. Who gets an autopsy? How is it decided?
Well, cases that are referred to the medical examiners are cases that are sudden, unexpected, or violent. So under the law, in most states, people get autopsies when they die under those circumstances. And the decision is up to the coroner or the medical examiner to do the autopsy. It's not by consent of the family.
No, it's not. Can they ask for it if they want to and get it done?
So, yes, families can also request autopsies. If someone dies in a hospital and it's a known and expected death, family members can ask that the autopsy be done at the hospital, or the doctors can ask the family for permission to do an autopsy, a hospital autopsy, in order to elucidate something in their care to figure out if the diagnoses were correct or if they missed something. Mm-hmm. But by definition, medical examiner or coroner's cases are cases that are unexpected deaths.
Right.
They're deaths at
right.
home or in the field or in unusual circumstances.
Our number, 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK. We're talking about medical autopsies with Judy Melinak, author of Working Stiff. We'll be right back after this break. Don't go away. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about forensic pathology. What can the body tell us about how a person dies? And why would anybody want to go into this business? Well, we're going to ask that question of Judy Melinak. She's a forensic pathologist and author of the book Working Stiff, 2 years, 262 bodies, and the making of a medical examiner. Our number, if you'd like to call, is 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry, SCIFRI. And so Dr. Melinak, what came over you as a when you were a doctor to say, hey, I like this?
Well, as I write in the book, I'm not a gruesome person by nature. In fact, I wanted to be a surgeon, and I found that surgical residency was much too grueling for me. I went into pathology thinking that the hours would be better, and they are, and the lifestyle's better. But I wasn't as passionate about it as I was about performing surgery and saving people's lives until I found forensics. Mm. When I worked at the New York City Medical Examiner's Office, I discovered that the process of going to crime scenes, meeting with individuals who have seen events that are really shocking in many cases, and by helping those people find closure when they're family members, that was a satisfying way for me as a physician to contribute. And I love the work. It's so fascinating. On a daily basis, I am excited by it, and I'm grateful that I can work in this field.
It's a real big mystery for you then every day when you go into the office.
A colleague of mine jokes that it's like the Forrest Gump saying, it's like a box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get. And forensics is like that.
Everybody watches all these CSI shows. And my favorite one is this little blue light they have that tells you everything about the crime scene. Do you have one of those?
Well, we do have alternate light sources that we can use in order to find things that are not visible with the naked eye. But what drives me crazy about the crime shows is that they're walking around in the dark constantly. I even wrote a blog post about this because the thing we do in science is we turn on the lights and we need to see the evidence in order to be able to collect the evidence. So I find that part of forensic TV drama to be completely way off.
And you also write in your blog post that, gee, they get those lab results back so quickly.
It's a problem because family members expect instantaneous results because they watch TV, and it sets their expectations. It also sets the expectations of jurors. And prosecutors have told me that there's this thing called the CSI effect, where jurors are expecting DNA evidence on every single case because of what they watch on TV.
And so then if you don't give them those results that they see on TV, they don't think that the prosecution is competent enough to win the case?
Sometimes. I think that there's been some studies that have shown the CSI effect is mostly people giving excuses for why the case was lost, when ultimately you need to have enough evidence.
Yeah. And you don't always use these high-tech tools. Some of them are from a kitchen supply store.
Yes, I actually have a kitchen supply store that was down the street from the medical examiner's office where I practiced for 9 years. They gave me a 10% discount as someone who's in the business, is what they said, because I got my knives sharpened there on a regular basis.
So what are some of the kitchen utensils you buy there, you use there?
Oh, I have just a standard chef's knife, a smaller knife, not a paring knife, but a little bigger. That's for cutting hearts. And then my shears that I use to snap ribs, those are from Home Depot, I think. I'm not certain.
The lopers that you cut off, that you would cut off the branches with, you're snapping ribs with.
That's what you prune. Yeah, those are the most efficient. There are ones that you can get in medical supply catalogs, but the pruning shears for rose bushes are much better.
Okay, let's go to the phones. 844-724-8255. Joe in Bucks County, PA. Hi, Joe.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Hi, yes. I have a college and career coaching business in Bucks, and I get a lot over the last couple of years that I think you would describe as the CSI effect also, that just desperately wants to go into this field. And I was just wondering if you could share a couple of sort of motivating tips or stories, and then maybe some more realistic tips or stories about getting into this field.
How do you get into this field? Good question. Thanks for calling.
I actually get this question a lot. I even created some frequently asked questions on my blog post because students write to me asking how to get into forensics. The most important thing is you have to be a good student. You have to study and you have to do well in school because every step of the way requires that you have the grades. So for students, I tell them focus on biology and physics and chemistry and get good grades. I also recommend that if you're interested in a career in the forensic sciences, you have to have a clean background. You can't get yourself arrested or be caught with any drugs because there are background checks in this field, and you need to be responsible and have a clean background in order to get a job.
Hmm. Let's go to the phones again to Penny in Ridgecrest, California, who thinks she's solved our mystery.
Hi. It seems to me that it was a delayed homicide, but that they missed the emergency
room personnel misdiagnosed the meningitis, and so the family might have a legal case against the hospital for misdiagnosis. I think the neck pain was the giveaway.
All right, we're not going to give it away quite yet, but is she close at all, Dr. Melnick?
Well, I want to address this issue of medical malpractice because besides this caller, thank you very much for calling, there were also people who commented on that on the website,
right,
that this was medical malpractice. One thing that people don't realize is that forensic pathologists can comment on the cause of death. We're qualified to say what the cause and the manner of death is. But for medical malpractice, you really need to know what the standard of care is for the physician who made the alleged error. So in this case, in court and otherwise, I can't give an opinion on standard of care for emergency room physicians. What we would need to be able to prove is that the doctors in the emergency room somehow deviated from the standard of care for this patient in order to say that this is medical malpractice.
Mm-hmm. Talking with Judy Melnick, author of Working Stiff, two years, 262 Bodies and the Making of a Medical Examiner. Delving a little deeper into that case that you gave us, how did your autopsy results help in that case?
In this case, the most important aspect of it was what is not written in it, which is his family members. His mom was very concerned. He's a young man, and she felt that this was really unexpected and wanted answers about what happened. So to be able to talk to her and explain what I found and what I thought the cause of death was is why it's important that we do what we do. It's the stuff that you don't see on the news. It's the personal interaction on the phone with family members, giving them answers and giving them closure.
Let's talk about this, your job with working with the police. Tell us about the guy who called birthday suit.
So that was a case where a guy had stabbed his girlfriend and they were naked at the time, and he had run outside and unfortunately locked himself out of his apartment and started knocking on the neighbors' doors. They didn't let him in, so he ran outside naked, covered in blood, and actually ran into some cops. So that case was interesting from a forensic standpoint because besides testifying to the cause of death, which was the stab wounds to the girlfriend, what I noticed when I was shown photos of the perpetrator was that he had scratch marks on him, and that indicated that she was resisting and that this was a fight. This wasn't an accidental stabbing.
So you needed to have then fingernails. Did you took fingernails off the body? That helped this?
Correct. So that's standard operating procedure for many homicides, especially ones where there's hand-to-hand or contact, is we will collect fingernail clippings from the deceased and that DNA evidence could be taken from that. But it's more than just the DNA. It's also looking at the defendant in this case and looking at the photographs of him showing the injuries to his body. So you interpret the DNA in the context of the injuries.
You spoke when we began about why you went into this business, and you talked about besides the 9-to-5 routine, a little more life, gives you a little bit more of life of your own. You seem to also indicate to me that you can get closer to people, which probably as a doctor you could not. You could not be as compassionate to them because of because the doctors, you know, don't do that. Would you agree with that? Do you think that you can balance being compassionate with giving yourself some emotional distance from these cases?
I can. In fact, I found being a surgeon much more difficult.
Yeah.
Because as a surgeon, I would see people suffer and I would see people die, and their families would be right there witnessing it. And sometimes I couldn't do anything, or sometimes I was causing them the pain because I had to in order to try to save their life. So I found that more difficult emotionally than doing what I do as a forensic pathologist. Mm. Here, the worst that has ever happened has already happened. And what I'm doing is trying to pick up the pieces, explain things, and give families closure. So it's really to some degree closer to psychiatry in terms of helping people with the grieving process. It's something that you don't see on the CSI shows, again, that forensic pathologists do interact with the families of the deceased. We do explain things to them. And we also have to testify in court. So we need to be able to explain things in simple ways without dumbing the science down.
Yeah, that's quite an interesting point that you make. But if I were a forensic pathologist, you know, I'm a geeky person, but not with bodies. I'm geeky with mechanical things and computers and stuff. And every time I look at one, I want to know how it's made. Do you walk down the street and look at people and say, uh-oh, what's going on inside that person's body and that person's body? And they're suffering from this and blah, blah, blah.
It is hard when you have some knowledge because, for one thing, I know people's general anatomy. I don't exactly have expert X-ray vision, but I have been in situations where people have come to me and asked me for their medical opinions because they find out what I do. Mm-hmm. Personally, it tends to be skin, dermatology, which is not something I like particularly, and I'm not a dermatologist, so I just refer them to their physician.
Right.
It's really upsetting sometimes, though, when you see someone on the street who's walking by and who's got a potentially fatal illness. I do discuss that in the book as well.
Sometimes the outside of the body, you talk about the skin, sometimes the outside of the body doesn't have a scratch on it. It's what's inside. Tell us about the Melinda Hain case.
Well, in that case, you know, she looked perfectly intact. She was beautiful, but she was in a motor vehicle accident and she had devastating injuries inside her body. Cases like that come to our office also because they're brought to the emergency room and the people die because they've been in some traumatic event, whether it's a motor vehicle accident or a fall, and the doctors in the emergency room don't know why they died because they die so suddenly and there's nothing on the outside. But then when we do the autopsy, we can find devastating injury on the inside.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Julie Melinick about her new book, Working Stiff. I can't let you go in a few minutes. We have without talking about the worst case, I think, that you talk about in your book, which is the gentleman who basically boiled alive like a lobster. Can we get away talking about that?
That was very hard. And it was hard for the people who witnessed it. And it was hard for me. That's the case that gave me nightmares, in addition to some of the other things I watched. The training process in forensics requires you to learn enough objectivity to do your job, but you need to keep your compassion in order to understand what the consequences are for the families. And when we testify in court, things like pain and suffering play into that. So we can testify to those aspects of a case. That case still resonates with me, and that's why I wrote about it.
Yeah. Well, let me see if I can get the answer. Let's go to the answer to our quiz. Let's go to Stuart in Durham, North Carolina. Hi, Stuart.
Hi, this is Stuart.
Hi, go ahead.
Hi, Dr. Melinick.
Hi, Stuart.
Hi. I was intrigued by it, got sucked in. It's like the mystery. And I guess what you had to decide whether was this death related primarily to the gunshot wound this person sustained, but it was, you know, at least 10 years prior to that. So I'm guessing that this infection, well, he died of the infection, but it was secondary to the gunshot wound, that this Staph aureus probably originated from some abscess on the skin and got into the blood. And normally the body would have taken care of it, the immune system. But because there is this bullet, this foreign body, and some disruption of the structure, it caused a place where the immune system could not get to the Staph aureus, and it grew. It was able to multiply around that bullet, and that became the primary source of the infection. And from there, it went to the meninges, and then later on, it went down the track to the eyes. So it was...
All right, let me get an answer. Has Stuart got the answer there, Judy?
He's very close. I should add some information. About 75 to 90% of cases of adult meningitis are not Staph aureus. They're organisms like strep pneumonia or Neisseria meningitidis. So Staph aureus is less than 1% of these cases. Mm-hmm. Where the caller really, really pinpointed it was, what is the source of the infection? If the source of the infection was the bullet itself, and we would only really expect that if he had the meningitis immediately after being shot or while still being hospitalized in the immediate post-shooting episode, then we could reasonably call this a homicide. But given that there's so many years delay and the bullet itself is not the likely source of the infection, it was probably something else that then spread through the blood. It's called hematogenous spread. So that's where your caller was right on the mark. Mm-hmm. And so then the source of the infection is really the factor. We may never know the source. He didn't have pink eye on the first hospital admission, only on the second. So given that we can't say within reasonable medical probability that the bullet itself was the source, it is more reasonable and more likely that this is a natural death, and that's what we communicated to the family. The other thing to know is that if we call something a homicide, the person who shot him, even though it was 12 years ago or more, can still be prosecuted for homicide, for murder or manslaughter, mm-hmm. depending on the circumstances.
All right.
So there is no statute of limitations.
A fascinating book. It's called Working Stiff. The author is Judy Melnick, forensic pathologist. It's out there. And we have an excerpt on our website at sciencefriday.com/workingstiff. Thank you, Dr. Melnick, for taking time to be with us today. Good luck with the book.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Ira.